Welcome to Punch Card Investing, a weekly show dedicated to all things value investing. Whether it be analyzing companies, pitching ideas, or discussing moves by the best investors in the world, we're trying to get one step closer to punching an investment off of our cards. Let's get started.
Thank you, Intro Man. Very much appreciate your consistent and honest effort, always coming through. And it's always a great time. You know, we got the end of the year. There's a lot of news there. Then we have the new beginning of the year. So there's always a lot of news there. It's just a good time. And it's been a very, very green start to the year after a pretty depressing red 2022. And we've seen some of the big tech names go through some pretty serious volatility, Meta included. That'll be kind of our jumping off point for this episode today, talking about Meta's earnings that the market seemed to just love. And it's shot up something like it's over doubled since its November lows, which is kind of crazy to think about, especially given the company's size. But anyways, we'll get to that in just a second. Before we do, be sure to check out all of the great stuff in the description below. We have our discount to Seeking Alpha, which you could take advantage of that to get a discount on their premium subscription, which gets you access to all sorts of different stuff on their platform and lots of different articles and no article limits or anything like that. So it's really nice to take advantage of that. And also it could go a long way towards helping us out if you use our affiliate link. You can also sign up for a free account there too. Same goes for ShareSite. If you haven't done that already, a lot of you haven't taken advantage of that, but that'll get you a discount on their premium subscription as well, which can be used to track your portfolio in all sorts of different ways, in a more comprehensive way than many of the brokerages that you might be using have. So check that out. And that also could go a long way towards help with the channel. They also have a free version as well. If you use our link and you end up signing up for a premium version later, we might get a commission from that. So we'd appreciate that too. So at least try it out. It's free. Anyways, how could I forget? Like, comment, subscribe. Can't forget that. All right, guys, shall we, do we just want to dive right into Meta? Anything else, but to kick off the show, any new things happening in either of you guys' camps?
No, very quiet over here in Australia. Just watching this very surprising market to start off the year. It's been a pretty crazy time.
I'll take Brad's nods as the same thing.
Yes, it's been wild. Just the earnings over the last couple of days, seeing everything just go, you know, just crazy volatility.
Seeing the media headlines change a lot has been kind of funny too. And started noticing it with Alibaba a few weeks ago. All of a sudden, the financial media is a lot more positive as the stock price. The media tracks the stock price. And then the stock price tracks the media. It's kind of a chicken and egg thing, but it's just been funny to look at. Brad, I've noticed both of you have been putting out more content than ever. It seems like Brad, you've been pumping out a bunch of videos lately. And then obviously Frank, you're back online, which is awesome on YouTube. That is, you've been plenty active on Twitter and with your newsletter. At least that's on pause for a while, but good to see you both, pumping out the content too.
Yeah, and you just had your head down in the sand trying to get this business up and running, right?
I don't know about head down in the sand, but yeah, that did take up a lot of time and energy, and it still is. But it's more I don't know if refreshing is the word, but there's a lot less uncertainty now that I've actually gotten into it. So it makes it it makes it more fun and less stressful. There's plenty of stress still, but it's addressable stress. With uncertainty, it's just like you're just kind of waiting and seeing what. If there's a problem in the business, you can usually jump on it, which is pretty fun.
Me and Brad are just making content while Jack's out there making money. That's the
I'm losing money on content too. So don't worry about that. Time and money. Someone asked on a recent video, they're like, when is your YouTube? Have you considered your YouTube like replacing your salary as a lawyer? I'm like, I don't know if you knew that I lose money on every video because I pay for editing. So it's way far from that, but keep doing it because I get to meet fine folks like you a lot more easily. And plus it's good for the branding, accountability, all that good stuff too. So work through ideas. There's a lot of good value outside of just potential monetary benefit, but that monetary benefit is not there for me. That's for sure. I don't know about you guys. You guys have bigger channels than I do. Speaking of your channel, Frank, how have things gotten off since you've come out from the shadows of YouTube?
Yeah, the response has been good. Like, the engagement as high as it was when I left. So good. After a 10-month break or something, I'm far less active though, trying to make kind of higher quality content rather than the videos I used to do, which is probably two or three kind of on the spot videos per week, not too much research going into them. It's kind of sharing thoughts on different things, but now I'm kind of putting a bit of research time into it. So it's a lot more time consuming, and with a new job I've taken, I have a lot less time. So I am struggling to keep up a schedule, but I'm only really aiming for one video every 2 to 3 weeks now. It's more of a hobby, I guess, now than previously when I was really trying to hustle, but I find it a lot more worthwhile and enjoyable to make, at least anyway.
That's good. That's the most important part, especially when you're, when YouTube becomes your full-time income, if that ever happens, you get in this weird spot where, okay, if you're going to dedicate all of your time to YouTube, then you're not really doing anything interesting anymore. You're just doing YouTube and then talking about making money from YouTube. Like, there's kind of a trap that a lot of finance creators seem to fall into.
I'm currently making $0 off of YouTube. After so taking so much time off, it fell behind the whatever the monetization thing is on YouTube.
So you got that passion still. So you're
not, I've
got
to get another 4,000 watch hours back, and then the dollars start flowing.
Oh, so it turns off your monetization? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think you have to post a certain amount, you know, some amount of time, otherwise it resets.
Interesting. I guess that makes sense, but that's a shame. Whatever, you'll start making a dollar a day again soon. Don't worry, Frank.
And that's about what it'll be.
All right, why don't we pivot here and get into Meta? We promised it in our title, after all. Surprise, Meta's not dead. Let's go ahead and pull up their earnings report here. Starting with the top line. Oopsie, that's just me. We want everyone. There we go. Top line is back up after declining last quarter, but pretty consistent really with last year, just looking at top line revenue. We'll get to CapEx in just a second, but $31 billion in Q4 in revenue, which is really just wild to think of. And that's advertising revenue, I should say. That's compared to $32.5 billion in Q4 of last year. So Q4 is always going to tend to be good for advertisers because holiday shopping season. So lots of people running ads for their products, but it's kind of more of the same if you ask me, just when it comes to the advertising business, which really is the core, which I would argue people were kind of forgetting about with all of Mark Zuckerberg's media fiascos. And he never does himself any favors with his marketing efforts, I will say. But the ads business is still clicking. Trying to figure out where. Oh, yeah. And then we can see Reality Labs revenue, still a very tiny portion of the business, despite all the CapEx spend. Posting a $4 billion operating loss on Reality Labs. That's on $700 million in top line for Reality Labs. So that's all the VR stuff, the metaverse stuff, if we can lump that all together. But still tiny compared to the ad business, which shouldn't get lost here. Not sure if you guys had any kind of initial reactions on it. I'll kind of switch over to the stock chart just to show you how the market took it. But you can see that in the last year, it's still down 40% from its high of 323 all the way back in February of 2022. Year to date, it's up 57%. And just in the last couple of days, it's up.
That's crazy.
It's up like close to 30%, I think. I forget how much it is exactly. But going back to November, it's up over double, which is pretty wild. The November lows were about $90, and it's up over 180 now, almost $190 per share. So just you better have a stomach for this one.
I kind of wonder if the market was just on edge waiting for the shoe to drop, you know, numbers to come in below last year. And since they were in line with last year, people are just like, okay, we're back on, right?
Yeah. And I want to say that when it got under 100, it seems like everyone was writing off Facebook completely. Not everyone, of course, but a lot of people were writing off Facebook completely or Meta completely just because of the large CapEx spend. They were spending like, they're spending about on average, like $9 billion in CapEx every quarter, but that's compared to about 4 to 5 that they were spending before they started this whole metaverse venture. So
an extra 4, basically.
Yeah, it's basically an extra 4-ish per quarter, which they can always stop if they wanted to. But people are treating that like, oh, it's over. Like their cash flow is gone, and therefore they're just out of it. But they made $5.5 billion in cash flow last quarter. Granted, it's Q4, so you're going to expect better numbers in general, but it's not dead. That's kind of all I'm getting at. And the ads business is still clicking. And maybe the sentiment has now switched back to, okay, maybe we were overreacting. The newness of the metaverse spending, maybe people have kind of gotten more used to now. And we'll see what happens next quarter, of course, because all this can change from day to day. We saw this massive run up in the last couple of days, so a lot can change in just a matter of one trading session.
It's interesting that I guess the real change in stock price, going back a little bit further, started around the time the layoffs got announced, which reduced some of that operating expenses that I think people were getting concerned about. But that hasn't even been seen as of yet with these
earnings.
That'll kind of come through in Q1. We'll start to notice a difference. And they've had a lot of additional costs on top of that with the layoffs and severance packages and all of those things. And I guess the other shift market-wise would be people are seemingly starting to think that the rising interest rates and inflation, all these things are slowing down. So maybe people just generally in the market are more open to owning these FANG type stocks again, but it's the market more broadly as well. So I'm surprised at the positive reaction. I think the results were like kind of as expected, and there's probably a lot of negatives I could find in there too, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a second, but I think it went up 20% after hours or something pretty crazy, which is surprising to me because most of this we already knew. We knew that the operating expenses were going to be down, but not yet. That's going into Q1, so that can't be the main reasoning. Revenue was down kind of about flat on a constant currency basis. Earnings per share, free cash flow per share year over year or compared to the Q4 quarter last year is all down significantly. Like there's nothing great jumping out other than the reduction in operating expense guidance and the reduction in CapEx expense guidance. Which makes it seem a little bit more positive, but still not overly great moving forward, in my opinion. And then things like the ads still gaining, but I think it's the pricing of ads was down 22% or something as well, which isn't good. But
yeah,
I'm surprised with how positive the market's been. Not to say that they didn't go over the top when we were trading it, when they were trading at $80 to $90 per share, whatever it got to.
Right.
I think that was probably a clear time to at least be paying attention to it. And I think a lot of value investors were, and a lot of value investors took advantage of that price. But I think this is more just resetting back to a normal of where they kind of should be with poor results, essentially, especially compared to historically what they've done.
I don't know if I'd call them poor, but yeah, they definitely weren't crazy results. And I would agree with you that they weren't surprising, which is why the reaction was surprising.
I don't know how it can't be poor. It's flat revenue, earnings per share and free cash flow down like 50%. Like it's a huge, relative to what people might have expected, I think you could call it okay, but they're not great results for a business that historically has compounded at 30% on almost every level of business.
Well, sure. If you compare it to 2 years ago, yeah, I mean, everything's going to look bad, but maybe just the 2022 just kind of doused the flames of the market to the point, or doused my expectations for a lot of things for this year, and probably a lot of people's, hence the reason they reacted like this. Maybe something like that. They're by no means great results. I don't mean to say that.
I think the other thing I'll just add in there is Reality Labs revenue was down year over year as well, a decline in revenue for what should be the fastest growing, maybe beside the short form video content, that's probably should be faster growing. But
yeah,
that was surprising to me.
And that's been sticking. And I think that's what people really were That seems to be what, I don't know if the media kind of latched onto that or just what investors were kind of latching onto from this last one, but the short form product Reels with Instagram and also Facebook short form has been doing really well. And that drives ad revenue, and hence the reason ad revenue has remained pretty solid, even in the otherwise not so good market for ads in general, I guess, compared to historical, if that's where you're getting at.
Have you guys seen any kind of guidance from Meta on Reality Labs expected revenues? I wonder if there's any kind of expectation from the company, because maybe they're just, you know, maybe it takes time to build whatever product they're going to be pushing out. It's just, we haven't seen it yet.
I haven't seen a concrete number. Have you, Frank?
No, I don't think they do it for just that segment alone. They kind of mostly just guide their expenses for the overall business, and they break down some of where those expenses are coming from. But no, I haven't seen an exact forecast. But it is expected that last year was meant to be a good year for Reality Labs, arguable whether it's good when it's burning that much cash. But they released, I'm blanking on the Quest or whatever it is, whichever the new Quest was. So I think maybe I'm wrong on that, but maybe with no new product coming out recently.
Yeah, well, we were talking before the show that I remember seeing that, I think on the App Store, the Quest, like the app for that was trending number one around Christmas time. So obviously a lot of people are buying them as gifts. So I am a little bit surprised kind of to what you were saying, that this wasn't higher, this Q4 Reality Labs revenue, given that Q4 last year was higher, and that was before the crazy spending really got going, which is, I don't know how to explain that one other than maybe it's just rougher times or the product's not sticking. But
well, you know, I think one difference now, people can actually spend on other things like experiences and travel. And
that's a good point.
A year ago, people were all cooped up. What else are they going to buy?
Kind of like video gaming in general, right. and anything digital. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, good point. Didn't think of that. What was I going to say? Something to what you had said, Frank. But one thing that was a bit worrying last time around, I was pulling up the balance sheet, was they were taking out some debt for the first time in a long time, long-term debt. They took out about $9 billion in debt in Q3. Thankfully, from a balance sheet perspective, they did not continue that. But the debt still remains at about $9 billion. That was pretty worrying. Like, why are they taking out a bunch of debt? They've never done that before, really, or at least in a long time. Meanwhile, they're spending all this money. Is this going to be like a debt spiral? Maybe that might have been part of the narrative. But now maybe that's less of a concern. Maybe it's something to go with that. Not sure if you guys have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, that is, that's not like Facebook to be taking out debt like that. So I can see people being concerned that there's such a change in approach.
Yeah, $9 billion in debt, but they still have about $14 billion in cash. And then short-term investments, about $26 billion. So 40 total in cash and short-term. So it's still plenty of liquid, even relative to the fairly high, historically high spending, we'll say, of the $9 billion or so per quarter.
I don't think it's anything to worry about yet, but it is notable, as I don't usually do that, but it's still such a large net cash position that as long as the cash flow keeps coming in, I don't think it's anything to worry about yet.
Yeah, that's well said. And then Art of Value also noted continuing their buyback efforts, $40 billion in buybacks planned. I don't know if that's the number, but it's probably something high because they have been doing that for a while, or at least promising that.
They got an approval for another $40 billion.
Okay, it was the 40.
And then the other thing, well, I guess this could probably be seen as a positive. Their operating margins are reported at around 20, 22%, somewhere around there. But a lot of that, they declared this kind of restructuring cost of $4 billion or so dollars, which would have taken operating margins closer to 30 to 32%, I think, from memory. You've got it in front of me there. 20% they reported. So yeah, up over 30%, I think, if that restructuring cost, which was to do with the layoffs and everything else as well. So I guess if you compare that to last year, margins aren't as bad as they kind of were looking in the earlier quarters, Q2, Q3 kind of last year.
Yep. But it is definitely something to keep an eye on as they kind of, well, like we've kind of discussed in the past, if they're going to be having a greater portion of the revenue coming from hardware, that's inevitably going to be a lower margin business than software, which is, you know, there's no marginal cost. So keeping an eye on those margins is going to be pretty big if they're expecting that to be a big portion of revenue in the future. But I guess in conclusion, they're not dead. Any of the thoughts on Facebook and Meta in general? I'm sure we got more thoughts, but anything pressing, I should say.
I guess the one thing we haven't really talked about yet is, well, we touched on it a little bit, but the monetization of WhatsApp and the Facebook Messenger, I guess, as well, which they even upped that run rate. I think it was 9 billion they originally said last year. Now they upped that to 10 billion of kind of annual run rate for that click to messaging or whatever they're calling it, which is just another source of revenue that's fast growing and interesting. If WhatsApp can become monetized effectively, then there's a whole nother line of growth that will be pretty exciting for Facebook shareholders, I think. What that looks like, I have no idea. I'm not smart enough to even understand what that kind of ad model really looks like. But a $10 billion run rate is pretty impressive either way.
Yeah. I guess anything's better than nothing, I guess, for something like that. It does show the power of attention. If you can maintain the attention, you can monetize that in a lot of ways. Some more easily than others. I can't imagine it. Neither of you guys own Meta, right?
No.
Yeah. I can't imagine that you'd be more interested now than before when it was sub 100, right?
Oh, certainly not. Mm-hmm. It was getting interesting when it was getting that low, and that was kind of when I was paying attention, but there's so much uncertainty that I couldn't feel comfortable with it. And there's so many different moving parts within the business that I really just couldn't, I guess, forecast or be comfortable with. And that's still probably the case. I would still be concerned that free cash flow is almost negative over the next year or so with some of these numbers that they're forecasting as well. So to be very optimistic, I think, would be hard at this price. Not to say that it's expensive or cheap, just it was definitely more appealing back when it was seemingly ridiculous at $80 or $90 per share, whatever it got to.
I'm officially green on the position now. I think my cost basis was like 170 because I had some over 200 pretty old shares. It was like a half position for me. But I kind of averaged down when it got close to 100. I would have liked to snag some more, but I got tied up with the business purchase. So the focus shifted. And to that, I think we should talk about capital allocation because I think it's a good kind of segue into that. Just capital allocation, portfolio allocation. We see Meta pouring a bunch of money into the metaverse stuff, VR and all that stuff, and pretty large scale investments, even in their relative terms. You know, $9 billion a quarter is a lot for pretty much any company. So what do we think about kind of, you call it bet sizing for different investments, or maybe speculative investments versus kind of core business investments? And then maybe we can kind of go into portfolio allocation from there. But within a company, Frank, why don't we kind of get in what you were getting at with, like, you know, moving parts, uncertainty and all that. How do you kind of weigh what a company like Meta is doing, where they're pouring a bunch of money into this fairly speculative project where you don't really know if it's going to yield fruit? Is that appropriate for companies to do? If it is, like, what's the limit? You know, I don't know if you can kind of touch on that.
Yeah, it's not a preference for me when someone, the head of the business and has kind of complete control over the business, at least for voting rights, can make these decisions that really can change the overall future of the business in a dramatic way. Yes, he can pull the plug at any time, so there's always that kind of in the back of your mind, I guess, but he doesn't have to do that. He can keep burning cash and hoping this is the project. you do have his track record that has been very successful with almost any of these acquisitions or large amounts of spends he's done over time. They've proven to be very fruitful, I guess, over the past 10 or 20 years, but we can't rely on that to be the case for the metaverse. One of the, I guess, misconceptions I think floating around there is a lot of this CapEx spend has gone towards the metaverse when it's mostly towards, from what I understand, the existing AI infrastructure and things like that as well. So it's not just the metaverse burning cash at the moment. They've kind of, due to some of the Apple problems and things they've had, they've kind of had to reinvest into their own existing infrastructure to kind of improve some of that. So that's probably a good spend. That's a necessary, I guess you're moving towards maybe a growth CapEx rather than a maintenance CapEx expend for some of that. If that improves in business over time, you could assume some of that is the case for the metaverse as well. How to split that growth versus maintenance CapEx would be very difficult in my mind. That's something I wouldn't be comfortable forecasting, at least anyway. But yeah, Zuck has a pretty good track record, but this is definitely the most critical time, I think, in his capital allocation decisions, especially when cash flows are kind of lacking at the moment too.
So would you say, sizing is the bigger issue then relative to your ongoing cash flow. Is that really what it gets at?
I don't know. It just depends what kind of assets and things he's putting that capital towards.
So you don't like how uncertain it is?
I don't like the type of asset, I guess. Yeah.
Okay.
The sizing would be fine if I could be comfortable with what the metaverse is and what it looks like in 5 or 10 years. And sure, maybe he does, but maybe that's why he's willing to put a lot of money towards it. But yeah, I guess that's the same thing. I would have been thinking the same thing about WhatsApp when the original investment, if I was paying attention when he first did that, I would have thought that was probably a bad idea because it would have seemed uncertain to me. It's turning out to be pretty great, you would think, at least on user engagement wise, and now they're monetizing it. So maybe we don't know whether this is good for 5 or 10 years from now, kind of like WhatsApp or even Instagram, I guess, originally.
Yeah, I was going to say Instagram as well. If a company, once you get to like this huge size that Facebook or any other kind of mega cap is at, if you're going to try to grow significantly, one of the more effective ways, even if it's seemingly ineffective, is to make more speculative bets with high upside. Like Google has tons of little ventures that they do, or little in relative terms, they're still quite large, but you know, they'll throw a bunch of money on a project, it doesn't stick, but then they hit YouTube one day, and then now that's a huge portion of the business too. Or they buy HTC and now they produce phones, and that's been pretty successful. You know, something like that. In Facebook's case, we mentioned Instagram as well. But you're inevitably going to have a bunch of losers too if you're doing kind of more speculative things like that, not really knowing what's going to happen. So is there kind of like a percentage threshold that you think, like, okay, once you reach a certain size, like, do you look at it like kind of like a formula? Like once you're a certain size, you have to spend X percent of your CapEx towards kind of speculative bets, or is that just like you'd rather not? It could really just depends on the management. Either of you
I don't know specifically to the Facebook example. I think it's hard just because I don't understand the different moving parts and what exactly that capital is going towards. But when it comes to like what Google's doing with essentially the venture capital, that's a fine way to spend money. It's not what I would personally do with my own capital, but I understand why a business like Google that has a lot of kind of cash flow laying around and they can kind of explore these different ways. And you're right, they did hit YouTube, which was amazing. I think it's similar to what Amazon did with AWS, which is now mm-hmm. the most valuable part of their business. So that works and that's fine. I think there's a lot more risk involved when Mark Zuckerberg takes on something like Metaverse or like he did with Instagram. The upside could be higher on these higher risk bets. That's what I guess you would hope for, at least as a Facebook shareholder. But yeah, there's no guarantee that's the case. It's a lot more safer when you're running those small little bets and hoping that a couple plays out and then funnel the money in once it does start to work out.
Are you ever comfortable with any amount of speculation? I feel like there's always going to be some level of being like, ah, this feels like a waste of money.
Yeah, sure. I speculate to an extent within the own positions that I'm investing in my own portfolio, but yeah, there's a threshold to it, I guess. The bigger the bet, the less I want to be speculative in nature. And I think at least appears, maybe I'm wrong. I don't have the information that Zuckerberg has, obviously. So maybe it's not as risky as I think it is, but it seems like a lot of capital going towards a fairly speculative investment. But that's from the outside. Again, from the inside, I could have a completely different outlook for that.
Brad, how do you think about that?
Well, I wanted to ask Frank a follow-up question. So, Frank, you put out a tweet in the last couple of days, I think, and you laid out a scenario where the likelihood was that something was going to zero, but there was a small chance of a pretty large upside. And you were trying to, you know, pull the hive mind about how you might size something like that. Did you take anything away from that?
Yes, I was going to plot the exact numbers, but I think it was essentially a 75% chance of a zero and a 25% chance of a 10 bagger or something along those lines, and how you would size a bet like that or whether you should make that bet at all. And if you use something like a Kelly criteria for that, you get to around a 17% position in your portfolio you should allocate to a bet like that. A lot of investors maybe go towards that half Kelly. So if you wanted to round it down to something around, say, that 8-9, maybe even 10% for that bet. But I still feel like I wouldn't be comfortable with that. 75% chance of a zero. I know mathematically you probably should bet a large portion, or 17% of your portfolio to be exact. But I still wouldn't be comfortable with that.
I think the trickier part with examples like that is that you're never really going to know what the upside is. On a speculative bet, especially, like, for example,
in the stock market. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Like, or just take the Facebook example or the Reality Labs example. What is the final market of VR? Who knows? Like, so how can you say it would be a 10x from here? You know, like, it's very hard to put a real number on it. And that's what makes it so hard. It's not like, okay, if they achieve XYZ, then they will get this. It's more like if they achieve XYZ, they might get, who knows? Like no one actually knows what the end result would be, even if they are, you know, pretty successful with the operation. So it makes it very hard to kind of look at it in that kind of mathematical way, which makes sense. Like, I'm not saying don't go through the exercise, but I think in reality, it's a way more difficult because you just don't even know what the upside is on a more speculative.
Yeah, that's essentially the problem with the Kelly criterion in general is that when it comes to investing, if it's an actual like gambling odds, which I guess it was originally used for, then it makes more sense. The odds are in place, but there is some kind of subjective nature to what the upside is, what the downside is, how likely, what the probabilities and everything else. I seen Eunice in the chat just said, yes, you should take that bet. And I agree. You should take the bet. The sizing is where I question it. I know when I make more speculative investments in my portfolio, I kind of size around the 4 to 5% mark, and that's when I think there's a lot of upside, but there is actually a chance of losing all that capital, which are bets I don't like to make too much, but I've got one sitting like that in my portfolio at the moment, and it actually looks like it's going to work out, but not as high as I wanted to. That was a buyout scenario, but I would size it smaller, around 3 or 5%, and I just find it interesting that at least theoretically, you should put almost a quarter of your portfolio towards it with a chance of losing, a 75% chance of losing that capital.
I forget it. In that example, did you mention timing of it?
I didn't mention timing in it.
Because that's another consideration too. It's like, is this a 10 bagger in 1 year or a 10 bagger in 20? Is now all of a sudden you have all this time to wait, that money is locked up, and you only have so many years on earth to wait. Especially if there's a chance you go to zero during that time, because let's say you wait 15 years for something to happen, then it goes to zero. Well, you only have so many 15-year periods in your life to wait for things. So those like high chance of zero bets suddenly become less attractive if you have to wait.
Yeah, that was a common comment that I got back.
Well, good comment, whoever left that.
But yeah, I think it kind of does relate to the somewhat with this metaverse investment. Yeah, I don't know how we should size an investment like that. I don't know what the upside is on the metaverse, and I would be willing to say there is a chance of a zero at least. In Reality Labs, I don't know what the probability that is. It's definitely not 75%. But yeah, it relates in that way where it's a high upside with a chance of zero. And how you size that, at least the theory or Kelly Criterion in general, doesn't sit well with me personally. And that could just be me personally. Maybe there are people that want to take on that little bit more risk. Maybe they're comfortable putting 17% towards a portfolio in that scenario that we outlined. But yeah, I'm just not.
SE358 maybe puts it maybe a different perspective here that I personally like, and was a reason I invested into Meta in general. What you do is you back out the spend, and then you count the metaverse as essentially a zero, and then you look at the rest of the business, the core business, which makes a lot of sense for rather than trying to guess what's the speculative portion of this business going to be. Instead, you can just be like, okay, let's just pretend that's zero, and this is a lottery ticket. Maybe it cashes, maybe it doesn't, but just pretend like it's zero. And now just focus on that core business. And if you can get that for a good enough price, then you have some extra upside baked in, as long as they don't go crazy and increase spend from there. Then you're trusting the capital allocators, aka Mark Zuckerberg in Facebook's case. But
you know, one question that comes up for me around that is, with all of this focus on Reality Labs, can we expect the core business to grow sustainably, or is it going to take a hit because, you know, there's engineers that are being pulled off the core business to work in Reality Labs? I don't know, you know, if that's actually happening or if it's an entirely different engineering set, but it's just a thought I have.
Well, yeah, there's always opportunity costs. I think the problem they like many other large businesses run into eventually is you just kind of run out of users to grab because they have billions of users and you can only add so many more. So it's like, okay, now what do you do? Do you just focus on the one product now that you've kind of addressed the whole market in a way, or like how much do you optimize from there? Or do you try to diversify without diversifying if possible?
The growth it doesn't need to just come from user growth, right? You can create a better and better product, squeeze more out of each person.
But, of course, right. But it's like that opportunity cost, I think, is a bit different when we're talking about a massive business that's already grown at such a high rate for so long. You can't grow at 30% forever. You just can't. You run out of money on earth. or I should say value on earth, because they could always print more money, but you eventually run out, you tap into everything. So at a certain point you kind of have to pivot at least a little bit. So that's why I don't mind the metaverse investment as much, as long as they know where to call it quits at some point if it ends up not working, which there's a fine chance that it doesn't. But if it does work, then great. Yes, I wouldn't want them to ignore the core business, and they aren't, because they're still spending, as Frank was saying earlier, a lot of their money towards a lot of their CapEx spend towards the core business. It's just they've now kind of added this more speculative end of the CapEx towards the Reality Labs portion.
And I doubt Zuck has any kind of guidepost like, okay, if we don't have traction by this time, you know, it's time to just cut our losses. Have you heard anything like that from him?
He hasn't said. I haven't heard that, but
yeah. I kind of said the opposite. Really, he's kind of at least from what he puts publicly.
Yeah, that's what he's posturing, at least. I would tend to trust that he's not an idiot, for as awkward as he might be talking, because he's gotten to this point, pretty much manning the whole operation, or at least leading the whole operation. Definitely not manning it. He's got thousands of employees, but. I would tend to trust that he's not that insane for all of his flaws, but eventually there is a limit here.
I think a lot of what the market,
that limit's pretty high because they have a lot of cash coming in. So they can do some things for a long time, so long as that core business remains okay. Which at the moment it is, but as we've kind of alluded to, it might not be in the future.
I think what the market kind of liked about this earnings report and the guidance and things is they are a lot more shareholder friendly, at least. They reduced the costs, the expenses that were coming in. They laid off a lot of employees. That was a big concern shareholders had. They approved another $40 billion worth of buybacks. Most people were saying, why they're cheap, that's what they need to do, buy back shares. So they're at least, he's appearing to be more shareholder friendly than a couple of quarters ago when he was just pushing nothing but the metaverse. So there has been that kind of pivot by Zuck or management, maybe more broadly, that might make shareholders a little bit more optimistic that they're not just going to burn all the capital. They are trying to maintain this existing business. And I guess the core business, you have to even break that down into sections. The what's bringing in the cash flows over the past 10 years isn't going to grow too much. Like the existing Facebook Blue and Instagram, the core part of Instagram at least, I don't think grows too much. If they want to continue growth beyond, say, GDP kind of levels or inflation growth, 3, 4, 5%, whatever it is, they need reels or short form video to be successful and bring in a lot more revenue, which so far it's looking pretty good. I think they doubled their engagement over the past year. Then you have, I guess, this click to messaging or whatever they're calling the WhatsApp and Facebook Messenger advertising. That's another source of revenue. Those two are more promising than I think your Reality Labs, which is your other segment. That if any of those three or all of those three work out, then the growth could be just as good as it has been. But they also have to care about maintaining that existing cash flow to even try and fund these kind of three side projects that I guess they're relying on for proper growth moving forward.
Sure. Yeah, I think that makes sense. But again, it wasn't that unexpected. They've been doing buybacks for a while. Kind of what we were saying earlier, it's just like the market reactions have been very intense on everything, everything Facebook, everything metaverse, for better or for worse. But when it comes to your own portfolio for both of you guys, we were talking about kind of speculative bet sizing, but what about just general investment sizing and like general position sizing? How much time do you spend thinking about that? Has that changed in recent years? What do you guys think about when it comes to position sizing in your own portfolios? Why don't we go to Brad?
Yeah.
I think you're pretty regimented with this, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's shifting though. I think a couple of years I was kind of in the, 25-20% bets camp, which is kind of looking a little bit insane to me now. Pabrai likes to tout the 10x10 portfolio. Guy Spear talks about, feeling like knowing where the water level is, where 10 is kind of, maybe up at your eyes and 5 is belly,
What makes you say 20 is insane though?
To me, well, just, my feelings around it, 20 strikes me as a little bit arrogant. Like,
okay,
that's a lot of confidence.
It is
to put 20% in. So I think the more I learn about, how difficult it is to really grasp all of the aspects of a business and take into account all of the risks seen and unseen, it's kind of heading back off from the 20%. Probably I'm more around the 10% level now, like a 10x10. But I can see that going even lower. It's not hard to imagine that somewhere between 5% and 10% is probably where I'll end up.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it totally depends on your investment goals. Like, what do you want to do with your money? If you're a conservative investor, then you would be as diversified as possible. You would own index funds. You would own probably some amount of bonds or something like that as well. But personally, at the hope of outperforming, which I've been lucky enough to do over a very short time period, I think you have to be concentrated. There's a lot of studies that kind of show once you go over 30 positions, it's just like owning an index fund anyway. Even over around 20 positions is correlates pretty close with a diversified index fund. So you have to be, in my opinion, to outperform, have the majority of your capital into, say, less than 10 positions. So you're looking at 10% of your portfolio in each stock roughly if you want to outperform. And there's diversified investors that outperform, so that's not a rule you have to follow. There is ways to do it. But generally speaking, I think if you want to outperform, the best way to do it is to be concentrated and be right. And being right is the hard part that most investors are not. Lucky.
Well, being concentrated is hard too when you get market swings like we've had recently.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, luck is also a factor. You could just be very concentrated and get lucky too. But yeah, I think generally speaking, I try to size a normal position, a full size position is around 10%, kind of have a 10 by 10 portfolio. But I'll hold a much larger position. So I did hold nearly half my portfolio for a while there, trimmed it back to around 15% in one position. So I'm willing to hold something larger than 10%, but original kind of buy-in price would be around 10%. And then, like I said earlier in the show, that occasionally you get these higher reward but higher risk positions, and that would be something like 5%, where at this point in my life, I'm willing to lose 5% of my capital. That would not be devastating to me whatsoever. But as I get older, I certainly won't be doing those type of positions, and I certainly will move more towards a diversified portfolio. I think about that more and more. Like, I turned 30 this year, so there's got to be an age or a point in time where I start to diversify, and maybe that's coming up in the next, probably over this decade at least. I'll probably generally trend towards a more conservative portfolio where I try to preserve capital more so than grow capital. But I think if you're young, particularly for any like kind of 20-year-old that earns a lot of money and their portfolio is small relative to their yearly income, they should be making pretty big bets if they know what they're doing. But a lot of times those people are wrong and they lose money. But that's what you've got to be willing to do, I guess, if you want to outperform. Most people, and I guess Buffett would say 99% of people or something, I think he's thrown out there, shouldn't be willing to lose capital and should just invest in an index fund. And I think that we had a comment about that. At what point would you just shift towards an index fund? Mm-hmm. And I feel like every day I get closer to doing that, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I think what you're getting at and what I totally agree with is that I think percentage bet probably is, until you have what I would call a mature portfolio to where it's more money than you'd ever really need, or it is the money that you would need to survive off of, that's really kind of where the shift is. As you approach that kind of like independence number to where, okay, you have enough money, now it's more about not losing it and trying to grow it maybe more modestly. That's kind of the consideration. So rather than percentage, before you get to that point, it seems more like maybe yearly income percentage or something makes a bit more sense or something like that. For example, if you're making $100,000 in a year, a $10,000 bet, I mean, we're talking about around, one and a half months of income. So like, is that serious? Maybe it is to you, but you know, it's if you recoup in a month and a half, first off, are you going to pay much attention to it if you're trying to actively invest? I think what I'm getting at is that it really just depends on where you are financially, which is what you were getting at as well, Frank, that it is more of a spectrum. Whereas if you're at like $1 million portfolio, and you only need $30,000 a year to live off of, and you're cool with that, you want to do a little bit of fire action, financial independence, retire early, then okay, then probably makes a lot of sense to diversify heavily and just maintain what you got because you don't want any more. But if you're trying to get to a massive level, then maybe you stay concentrated. So I think it really depends on that. I just pulled up my portfolio graph. And here's my percentage allocations now. This is including the private business I bought, but it's now a 64% in one, you know, stock. We'll call it a stock, even though it's private business. So it's definitely not nearly as liquid as the others, but it is just kind of funny to look at and how it definitely changes how I'm weighing the other holdings. One thing I'm considering doing, which I think I mentioned on a previous episode a couple of weeks ago, is just consolidating these public stock holdings down into maybe a couple or a few holdings from there, just further consolidate. If not, simply just rolling this whole portfolio into either another private business or into this one or something like that. I actually am in talks, very early talks with a competitor business in the area. That's also in the same space, potentially doing something like that. It definitely changes your incentives when you have like massive concentration into something that you're going to pay a lot of attention to it. And if that's not really a big amount of dollars compared to your net worth, your income, you know, especially your income at a younger age, is it really even worth doing? Or would you rather just keep it in cash, wait till you have some more cash to invest, and then you can make one of those big concentrated bets that's a big portion of your income? We were talking about this earlier, but I feel like I'm kind of aging in reverse with my portfolio, going from like extremely diversified down to more and more concentrated. It's kind of weird. We'll see if I'm right in the long term to do that, but that's what's going on now.
Frank, I wanted to ask a quick follow-up. So you said one position ran up to maybe close to half of your portfolio and you trimmed it, but it sounds like trimming it had nothing to do with you feeling like it was, you know, too big relative to the other positions in your portfolio. It was more something happened with that company that gave you less confidence, and that's why you trimmed. Is that right?
Yeah, I would say that's like 80% of the truth. As much as I would like to be perfectly comfortable having half my portfolio in one stock, it was always on the back of my mind. So there is kind of that relief when the story changed and I had more of a reason to trim the position, not sell the position, which I think some people might do in that case, just kind of collect their check and run. But it's still one of the larger positions or equal to largest positions in my portfolio. But yeah, most of it was because the outlook changed, the future returns changed. So there was lots of reasons to change it, but it was uncomfortable holding 50% of my portfolio in that. And then another thing I just wanted to pull up and kind of ask you, Jack, maybe around the real estate question by Alexander Hunter. He said, it's strange that most people see putting most of your investment into only a couple of stocks as like a high-risk investment, I guess he means, when people have 500% of their net worth leverage into their house.
Right.
That's an example I've probably used myself in the past. He followed up in the next comment saying that's one very illiquid kind of investment. The thing I don't like about that comparison is you get utility out of a house, assuming it's the home that you live in. If it's an investment property, that's kind of a different story. But there is a utility to having a house for you and your family to live in for the next 20, 30, 40 years.
And you've got to pay rent anyways.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So even if you were just renting a house, if you know you're going to rent a house for the next 20 years, you kind of are making this X amount of dollar investment for the next 20 years just to live there. And it's completely gone. It's a zero at the end when you move out renting wise. So I don't think the house example or real estate in general, if you're living in it, is a perfect comparison. But I would like to get your take on that, Jack. I guess that's a bit more down your field.
As someone who owns a couple of properties that where it's kind of like that, it's, let's see, I have one of them is about 300%. My house is about 300% of my net worth. One of my rentals is also about 300% of my net worth. Another one's 200 and another is about 100. So yeah, it's, if you just look at each one, but it is a bit different. I would consider it a lot more. I think real estate, I've increasingly think of it as like the best defensive asset, in that you have, at least in the US, you have lots of great tax benefits. It's probably going to track inflation in most cases, as long as you're not in a declining area, which isn't always a guarantee. It has great financing options if you want to do that. And you could, that's how you can leverage up your investment. You got to be careful, of course. And there's abilities to increase rents, which increase property value in many cases. But it's really kind of a way to preserve wealth. And you probably shouldn't expect, you know, double-digit returns on your real estate anytime soon, unless you're doing something really active with it or you're just doing crazy debt magic. But then the risk really isn't the real estate, it's your debt. Where I was getting with that is I see real estate as far more defensive than a company, especially a company that doesn't own real estate, that kind of baked in, just because you have something with utility, like you're saying, Frank, and that's kind of insulating you a good bit. It's a very liquid market relative to many other things. Yes, it's less liquid than stocks, but houses trade all the time. Rarely do people stay in the same house for more than a decade. I think the average is like 7 years or something that people buy and sell houses in the U.S. So it's a pretty liquid market in that sense. And the only problem with it is it's highly subsidized by the government. So it's kind of dependent on that in a lot of ways. But without rambling too much, yes, I think it's kind of goofy to own like a house that's 300% of your net worth, but then you're worrying about a stock that might be 5% of your net worth, and you're spending all of your mental energy towards that. It does not really add up that much. And that's kind of why I've been consolidating over the last year or so, pretty heavily, because that equation just felt out of whack. I was spending all this return on invested brain damage that I like to quote from Bill Ackman. It's a real consideration. I first heard it from Tom, so I credit Tom for quoting Bill Ackman to me. And like, it makes a lot of sense. Depending on how much brain damage the house would give you, that kind of goes towards the bet size or how much time you should spend thinking about it. If you're living in it, it's probably less stress and worry about how much money you're spending on it versus an investment where you're trying to make money. Like a stock, you might be worried more if something goes down in value there. Whereas with your house, you're like, well, I'm not moving anyways. I got a roof over my head, the utility, like you're saying. So that's a very long-winded answer there, but that's kind of how I would begin to think about it. It's really that return on invested brain damage idea. And maybe it's just also being comfortable with the asset itself too. I'm pretty comfortable with real estate, less comfortable with speculative, metaverse investments. So
yeah, the downside is kind of minimal, where it's almost impossible to absolutely zero. Relative to what a stock could do, it's a lot lower. Like you'd have to be.
It's dependent on debt. The debt kind of throws that whole equation off. But yes, if it was cash value to cash value, yeah, for sure. Yeah, then I would definitely agree. But debt's where people get in a lot of trouble with real estate, so you got to be careful there.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I don't see a primary residence as an investment. I like Robert Kiyosaki's definition of like, is it putting money in your pocket each month kind of thing? That's true. And it's not. I mean, you could argue, well, I would be paying rent, and so effectively it is, but that's kind of a workaround, I think.
Yeah. House hacks are that's a real workaround where you buy a house and then rent out extra space.
That's legit. Yeah.
That's totally how I started. And it was wonderful when you're just starting out and you're not making a ton of money yet. To just basically eliminate or subsidize your housing costs significantly allows you to really get that ball rolling. So I vouch that for pretty much anyone, at least look into house hacking, where you can take advantage of that great owner occupied financing, which is available in at least the US, but other countries as well tend to have good owner-occupied financing options, at least compared to investment financing, if there's any at all. But I always think that's a great way to start, just because you get that ball rolling, you can start saving money more aggressively and focus on other efforts rather than worrying about paying rent as much.
Yeah. I'll just pull out this comment quickly from The Art of Value because it kind of got me thinking. He said, I think 10% of wealth in a home would be ideal, but it's a privilege to get that to that point. Which kind of made me think, if I had $100 million, my position sizing for a house would be very small. I would likely still only own 1 to 2 homes, even if I had $100 million personally.
You wouldn't buy a $10 million house, Frank?
Probably not.
You can make some pretty sick content out of that.
I would.
Cribs, so, baby.
Well, to be, there's my allocation. If I had $100 million, I'd probably buy about a $2 million house. So I'd put 2% towards a house. And I might own a second one.
You should see how far $2 million gets you in Houston. My goodness.
Well, I'm thinking about where I live. $2 million here is a...
$2 million in Houston is like... I'm always in shock just coming from even Chicago, which I can... It's probably quite a bit cheaper than where you're at right now.
Well, I live in country Australia, so... That would be an absolute mega mansion in the town I come from. So,
okay.
Yeah. Sydney, different stories. In Sydney, that gets you a one-bedroom apartment at this
rate. Yeah, right. I was thinking more along those lines, but okay.
yeah. But yeah, I just think it's a good way to think about it. It is relative to like the way we can access real estate makes sense why people would put 300%, 400% of their net worth towards it, I guess.
Yeah. Either way, you got to be careful with any leverage. That's for any investment. Even though real estate, we're arguing, is safer than other things, you can make it very unsafe with debt. And a lot of people have been burned doing that. Seeing it a ton right now with short-term rentals, where people are just expecting massive occupancy and short-term rentals in super hot areas, paying like extremely high prices for a house that really is not designed to be a rental, but they're trying to turn it into a short-term rental. Then they realize that there's something called a down season, and now they're in trouble. So like you can really just burn
the mortgage. Yeah. If you can't cover the mortgage, doesn't go under away. Any situation, it is a risky endeavor.
Right. Exactly. Real estate itself, if you just buy it straight up, I don't think is a very risky investment at all, but you make it risky and you juice up the potential returns as well, just because of the debt. So that's why I kind of see it as more defensive in itself. You can make it a little bit more offensive when you introduce a bunch of debt, but you know, now you're changing the equation quite a bit. So be careful out there, kids.
I just want to quickly, before we do wrap up, I know we're getting towards the end, but I'm curious to get your thoughts on, I guess, like the more risk-free assets. So I guess we're kind of on topic here.
Like treasuries?
Well, yeah, bonds are going through a pretty strange time at the moment where I think – so the 60-40 portfolio, which is talked about a fair bit, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, last year had its one of not very many down years. I think it was down around 10% or so, maybe even a little bit more. But bonds are kind of this reaching this interesting point, I guess, where if you're a defensive conservative investor – are they starting to make sense, or do they affect the way you invest at all?
They haven't affected it yet. I have thought about it a little bit, but right now I've got lots of things I'd rather put the cash towards, including paying down my own debt. So putting a bunch of money into 4% treasuries versus paying down 10% debt, I'd rather just do that for now.
Or growing your business, right?
Right, exactly. However, for reserves, I might start thinking about that some more rather than leaving it in a savings account. But then again, savings accounts now, high yield ones, can get you, you know, 3% in some cases. So am I going to lock it up into treasuries for a year, 6 months, whatever? Or do I just leave it in the savings account? It's totally liquid and I'm losing 1% of delta. You know, is that really that big of a deal? I think I need a lot more cash to really start worrying about that. And right now I've got a lot of stuff to put cash into.
Yeah. Where did those 10% crypto savings accounts go? those would be handy right now.
Yeah. The 20 plus ones. Free. Definitely not using any leverage at all. Totally no. Safe.
FDIC backed.
Yeah. Yeah. how do you guys think about it? How are you thinking about it, Frank? You posed the question.
Well, the main reason I think about bonds is like I kind of am working towards structuring my future portfolio. Like I always wonder what my portfolio will look like when I'm reaching retirement age.
Sure.
And certainly when I'm retirement age, I will have a certain percentage of my portfolio in bonds, probably similar to maybe a 60-40 portfolio or along the lines of like Dalio's all-weather portfolio. something that's not very volatile and still grows at a relatively nice rate. But yeah, I just like to pay attention to it and see how people think about it. I'm kind of in the same boat as you, Jack, where at the moment I'm fine to take on higher risk investments and lose money at this point. So I don't think about it too much other than kind of getting a sense of what the overall market is thinking by following treasuries to some extent. But even that's mostly entertainment, I guess.
Yeah. And I think it just changes when you have more to lose. Like right now, if I went to zero, yeah, that would suck. I wouldn't be happy about it. But I both have time to make it up. And at least in net worth terms, like, yeah, I'm losing a good chunk, but it's nothing I couldn't make up in a lifetime for sure. If I had, you know, $30 million more than I would ever possibly need, then yeah, I'm going to be a lot more conservative, have a much higher cash balance, keep it liquid. And I might start worrying a lot more about, I would be worrying a lot more about treasuries and ways to bump up my cash return, if that's a thing.
Well, unless you had a foundation as well, right? Like Dakshana, and you wanted to put all these kids through school.
Oh, I don't know about that, but yeah, I do want to have a foundation at some point, or at least do some serious like nonprofit work. I have a few things in mind, but without getting into detail, but when you have a large thing of cash, you don't really want to risk in a big way, then. Now treasuries actually pay you something. Maybe not a ton relative to inflation, but it's certainly better than 0 or 1% or whatever. So it's not return-free risk anymore. Cool. Brad, did you have any thoughts on that?
No, it's not something I've looked at. But yeah, I get that it makes sense for a lot of people. Just
Frank's thinking way ahead. He's like,
that's great.
Reconstruct my portfolio.
Go, Frank.
When I'm fully retired, he's on the doorstep. He's right there.
He's a planner.
Yeah.
I'm in this strange point of life where my income keeps on going up and up pretty quickly in a lucky sense. Like my new job's paying a lot more. I can make some money online as well. So yeah. I'm starting to think I have less time towards investing. So maybe these defensive
plays. Is that inflation adjusted boost in income?
It is. It is.
My income went up 10%. Wait a second.
But yeah, so I start to think that maybe I'm going to have less time to focus on a stock portfolio and maybe I have to be a little bit more conservative. Again, that's not yet, but I could see myself entering that again over this next decade. So I pay more and more attention to the defensive strategies in investing, I guess.
And you always got to have a long-term plan in place, and that it always changes. But I certainly like planning. I think we all do. Just have like at least some idea of like, okay, I'd like to be here. Here's a number. Here's an allocation, whatever it is. And then here's a general vague path to get there. And then that's the short term is what changes all the time. But you try to at least break it down into addressable steps. It's always good to think about at least a little bit because you'll eventually be there. And then it's like, okay, now what? Rather not scramble.
Right. Yep. The numbers will be wrong and that's okay.
Right. As long as you're in the ballpark.
It's not about the numbers. It's about having a plan.
And plus if you overshoot it with your goals, you can, it's not so bad if you fall short on a massive goal or relatively massive goal. You still made big progress as long as you're making those steps towards something decent that you want. On that positive note, I think we could wrap it up. Thanks everyone for dropping by, for talking to us about whatever we talked about today. We talked about the metaverse a little bit. We talked about the massive bonanza that we're seeing with Facebook stock up double since November. How amazing. And we talked about portfolio position sizing within a company, within a portfolio. How do you size bets? How do you think about that? Lots of good stuff. You know where else you can find good stuff? In the description. You can find the links to ShareSite. You can find the links to Seeking Alpha. Those are great affiliate links. They go a long way towards helping the channel. You can help yourself out as well because there are discounts on those products. So check that out. Also check out the Discord if you're not in there already. And like, comment, subscribe as always. And until next time, everyone, see ya.
Thanks for tuning in to Punch Card Investing.
The contents of this show should not be used as investment advice or as a recommendation to invest in a particular security. Please consult with a licensed investment advisor if you need investment advice. All investments carry risk and the potential for monetary loss. Thank you, and see you next week.